From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
The staff had taken over the back dining room. The servers looked like actors, each perfectly idiosyncratic but rehearsed. They were performing, snapping, clapping, kissing, cutting each other off, layers of noise colluding while I sank into my seat.
That's our guest Stephanie Dandler reading from her new novel, Sweet Bitter, about a naive 22-year-old who comes to New York and starts working at an upscale restaurant. Dandler draws on her own experiences in the restaurant industry.
There is one bar where all the servers tend to congregate at 2 a.m. That also happens to be a time of night when people get into trouble. I don't think anything good has ever happened between the hours of 2 a.m. and 4 a.m.
Also, Ken Tucker reviews singer-songwriter Margaret Glasby's debut album, and John Powers reviews The Witness, a new documentary that re-examines the story of the murder of Kitty Genovese in 1964. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. If you eat in high-end restaurants, regularly or rarely, you expect exceptional food and friendly, attentive service. Our guest today, Stephanie Dandler, peels the curtain back on what it takes to deliver that food and service in her new novel, Sweet Bitter. Dandler's worked years in the restaurant business, and the story's told through the eyes of a 22-year-old woman who comes to New York to start a new life and is quickly immersed in the frenzied workplace culture of the restaurant and the equally frenzied after-hours social life of restaurant workers. In a New York Times review, Chef Gabriel Hamilton called Sweet Bitter true and beautifully written and said she actually missed a plane she was waiting to board because she was so engrossed in Dandler's description of an unannounced inspection by the health department. Stephanie Dandler holds a master's in fine arts in creative writing from the New School. Here she is with a reading from Sweet Bitter, which is her first novel.
There were tables in the back dining room set with stainless steel sheet trays and bowls so big I could bathe in them. Macaroni and cheese, fried chicken, potato salad, biscuits, an oily green salad with shredded carrots, pitchers of iced tea. It looked like food for a large catered event, but my trailer handed me a white plate and started helping himself to family meal. He went and sat at a table in the corner without inviting me to follow. The staff had taken over the back dining room. They came from every department. The servers in aprons, people in white coats, women removing headsets, men in suits tugging at ties. I sat near the servers in the very last chair, the best seat if I needed to run. Pre-shift turned out to be a turbulent affair. A frazzled, skittish manager named Zoe was looking at me like it was my fault. She kept calling out numbers or names, things like Section 6 and Mr. Blah 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 at 8 p.m. But the servers talked right through her. I nodded deftly. I couldn't touch my food. The servers looked like actors, each perfectly idiosyncratic but rehearsed. It all felt staged for my benefit. They wore striped shirts of every color. They were performing, snapping, clapping, kissing, cutting each other off, layers of noise colluding while I sank into my seat.
And that's Stephanie Dandler reading from her new novel, Sweet Bitter. Well, Stephanie Dandler, welcome to Fresh Air. We've all had this experience of starting a new job and not knowing the ropes, right? That's normal. And I assume you'd had started many new jobs by the time you got into the restaurant business. But I wonder, was there something different about these people? Are restaurant people different?
Restaurant people in New York are different. So my first restaurant job was when I was 16 years old. I started as a hostess, and I've never worked in another industry. But when I got to New York, the level of professionalism and the seriousness of the industry totally blew me away. Here you have people that aren't just holding server jobs while they pursue something else. These aren't temporary placeholders in their lives. This is actually giving them the life they want. They're professional servers. They have health benefits and vacations. They own homes. They have children. There's growth. It is a viable industry. And in 2006, it was not quite as common as it is now that we've seen the explosion in food culture to have these professional servers. But I fell into that world and fell absolutely head over heels in love with it, much like my character in the novel.
Right. And when you're coming in to people who are expecting a certain standard and you're a complete newbie and don't know much, it must be pretty intimidating.
It's incredibly intimidating. Restaurant culture has its own version of hazing and initiation, and you get a uniform and you get a nickname and you learn a new language, and everything is over your head initially. And I think the first part of the book, which takes place during summer while she's training, she barely speaks. She has no voice yet. And that is very true to what I experienced. And I think what most people experience when they enter a new field and they have to learn the ropes very quickly on the fly.
Yeah, her nickname's, New Girl Fluffy, was it? Fluffer?
Fluffer.
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 Not the most flattering thing to be called.
An assistant of sorts.
Yeah.
No.
What kind of
nickname? They call her Skipper. They call her Pop-Tart, Baby Monster. There are a lot of diminutive nicknames throughout the novel, and restaurants are a nickname culture. Everyone has one.
What nicknames did you have when you started?
I don't think I can share that. Let's say they were similar to hers.
Okay. tell us a little bit about the hierarchy in the restaurant. What were the different jobs and kind of the social structure that emerged from them?
So this is particular of a Danny Meyer restaurant in which there are no busboys. There is instead a back waiter or a back server. And what that means is that everyone is expected to be at the same level as the servers, but you are assisting them. You're clearing their plates, you're opening wine for them, you're setting the tables up while the servers are kind of the showmen who are talking about the specials and explaining the different bottles of wine. Above the servers, generally, you have the bartenders who have been there the longest. The bars are kind of the emotional center. It's the emotional center of this novel and this restaurant. But most restaurants I find, I gravitate towards the bar. It's the bartenders seem to be the keeper of the wisdom of the place. And they also know how to make a great drink quickly. Above them, you have your managers. And then above that, you have the general manager, who in the novel I've envisioned as a sort of puppet master. Above that, you have the owner, who is more of a voice than an actual presence in the restaurant. He speaks almost like a deity.
Right, referred to as the owner. I don't even know if we ever learn his name.
No, his name isn't important. At that point, the owner is not actually making the restaurant run, but he's informed the ethic of it.
There was a lot to learn in the job, and it was also physically taxing, at times painful, injurious, wasn't it?
Punishing is how I always think about it. I personally, in my life, went back to waiting tables when I was 30 and I was in graduate school working on the novel. Before that, I had been managing restaurants and the beverage director for a restaurant group, and that is a terrible job in its own way. It's 70 hours a week. It takes all of your brain. But I had forgotten about how the joints in your wrist just ache all night, and the heels of your feet. It's so physically punishing to be running for 10 hours, bumping into people, carrying bus tubs down the stairs, and trying to maintain a sense of elegance while doing it all. Incredibly taxing.
There's a moment when you say there's a ballet among all of these people that are carrying things, occupying the same space, you know, performing different tasks, and they just somehow know to work it like a choreographed dance troupe.
Absolutely. And Tess, the protagonist, is so aware of it because she's trying to fit into it. She's trying to understand how to anticipate movement. At a certain point in the novel, she stops observing it because it's become automatic to her. She's been absorbed by the ballet. But I think about how if one person is moving in the wrong way, it will throw off the entire flow of the restaurant. I still see that when I walk into restaurants. I'll see a bartender who's way behind on drinks and tickets are printing. And I know that if the drinks aren't being delivered, the table's not going to get their appetizers until afterwards. It's so precise, the choreography, and it's so necessary to make the machinery run well, that when one little part of it is off, you can feel it everywhere.
Which makes for a real intensity for everybody on every shift.
Absolutely. The novel is about intensity. It's intensity of taste, intensity of smells and noises, but also an intense presence of the movements going on around you.
Stephanie Dandler's new novel is Sweet Bitter. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and we're speaking with Stephanie Dandler. Her first novel is called Sweet Bitter. You said the bartenders are above the serving staff, and how did you put it there, the hold the wisdom of the restaurant? What do we mean by that?
Bartenders, The bartenders that I've worked with tend to have been there for many, many years. They're often the most senior servers. When you're behind the bar, it's as if you're up on a stage and you're protected from the guests in a way. A lot of servers don't want to be bartenders because you're being watched all the time. You can't disappear into the kitchen. You can't disappear into a hutch. But that job, typically, you make the most money. You've been there the longest, and you have these really beautiful interactions with the guests. It's very casual. People come and go. People also linger. And I think that bartenders are often the people that the servers will look to help maintain control in the restaurant, or the managers will look to them as well to help kind of police or manage what's going on.
The jobs are physically demanding, but it's interesting that you describe that an important part of what goes on, maybe one of the most important parts, is the way the wait staff, the servers, all deal with the guests. And there's a kind of, I don't know, what would you call it? Intimacy or affected intimacy? You want to talk a bit about people who do that well and what it's like?
Yeah, and I'm going to borrow a little bit from Danny Meyer, actually, because in the novel, I've used his concept of the 51 percenter. The idea being that 49% of the job of serving is the mechanics. It's the ability to three-plate carry and drop the plates at the table number and to show up on time and work the micros terminal. But 51% of the job is what he's hiring for. And he has these skills that he says compose a 51 percenter. But what I've narrowed it down to over the years is empathy. It's this ability to deeply empathize. Once you're doing that, you can anticipate needs, which is what the next level of serving is, to know that you would like another Manhattan before you've even registered that you're finishing your first one, to overhear that it's someone's birthday and put the writing on the plate or put a candle in the dessert, to see that it's raining and bring out a stash of umbrellas. That's the 51 percenter mentality. But what it takes is this empathy and compassion that Danny says you can't train people for it. They have to be born that way.
Yeah, it's interesting. And you're right that in this restaurant, there are regulars who come in and people get to know the regulars and sometimes a lot about their lives. And I'm wondering, after you develop this empathy with the guests and deal with them so expertly, that then after the shift, do people talk about their guests in mocking ways, or do you feel a real identity with them?
The regulars do become a part of the family, the restaurant family, and in that way, they get teased or mocked like anyone else within the restaurant family. But it's typically with love. That's been my experience, because these people are coming back. They're part of the landscape of your evening, and you're spending your time with them. But definitely, to be totally candid, there is mockery occasionally.
Tess, the one who comes to New York and is at the center of this novel, you know, discovers a whole new world. She learns of food. I mean, she learns to distinguish the tastes of different kinds of oysters or a rare sea urchin that is served at a point. And she learns all about wine. When you came to this business, was it an aspiration for you to develop a palate and learn all this stuff? Or did this come to you by experience?
It was definitely an aspiration. I was so far behind, and I thought that I was fairly sophisticated, like most of us do when we're 22. And then you walk into Union Square Cafe, and even the back waiters know all the different appellations in Burgundy, whereas I was drinking Yellowtail still, which has animals on the label. So I definitely took to it and studied in the off hours and wanted to reach their level and become a professional in the industry. That experience is very personal, the experience I describe in the book. And at this point, it's the way that I live my life. But I had to go back to accessing all of those firsts, all of the first tastes when I first moved to the city.
Was there a moment when you were new to this that kind of taught you, wow, I really don't know very much?
When I moved to New York City, it was in the summer of 2006, and I loved tomatoes. I was one of those kids that had always loved tomatoes and thought that I knew what tomatoes were all about. And I had my first heirloom tomato in the restaurant, in a dish that Chef Carmen Qualiata prepared at Union Square Cafe. And it's a fruit at the height of its season, and it's 2 weeks when the tomatoes are absolutely perfect. And I come from Southern California. I can get tomatoes all year round, but I had never tasted anything like it. And I just thought, oh, this is what a tomato tastes like. I've been so lost my entire life. It's moments like that that I try to get really explore in the novel.
Right. And you can multiply that by dozens of other things, truffles and wines and everything.
Right. And I think the most important thing to me when I was writing those scenes was that they be essential to Tess's transformation. I think that food is so easy to write about in a way that adjectives just start flowing and you're like, oh, this is gorgeous. Let's keep going. But if it's not essential to the journey that the protagonist is on, it's throwaway. There's so much food writing on the cutting room floor. So the things like the oysters, the truffles, the tomatoes, those are all moments when Tess is transforming, and you can't take the food out of those scenes.
It's a high-quality place. I mean, the Union Square Cafe was a well-known place when you worked there. These are, on the other hand, restaurants in New York City, and there are issues of rodents and insects and the like. What did you see when you were working there? And that restaurant or others?
Yeah, let's say all restaurants.
Okay.
Because I've been very blessed to work in some of the cleanest restaurants in New York City. And when I managed restaurants, for the proverbial record, I always received an A at everywhere I worked. That's an A in the health code grading system of New York City. But when I got to New York and saw that there were insects or rodents, or that there was trash on the street, or that the park that I love to nap in during the day was covered with rats at night. These are facts of the city. And I think no one around me was concerned. And so even though I didn't have a context for it yet, I hadn't lived in the city for 10 years, I could see that everyone else wasn't fazed. So I thought, oh, this must be normal.
Right.
And it is normal. So much of it is out of your control. If they're doing construction next door to you, if the place next door to you isn't particularly clean, if you're close to a park, there's really so little you can do about it.
So despite all the best efforts, there will be insects, there will be rodents in the restaurant, in the kitchen, in the storage places?
I think that is true of most places. Can I leave it at that?
Okay. Before we leave the subject of cleanliness, I want you to read this section. This is late in the book, where a health inspector shows up at the fancy restaurant on Union Square.
Yeah. There's a scene late in the novel when the health inspector does come to the restaurant, and it was a very traumatic scene to write, but people seem to enjoy reading it, so I'll read a little bit from it now. Scott, drained of color, said, "The health department's here." Chef set down his knife and in the quietest and most controlled of voices said, "Nobody touch the fridges." The kitchen detonated. People ran. Chef flew up the stairs. From all over the kitchen, things went soaring into the garbage, half a leg of prosciutto and the ropes of sausages hanging by the butcher station. Bar mops dropped into the trash like streamers. Anything that had been out, in the process of being chopped or even salted, went into the trash. Potatoes that were being sliced for fries, breakfast radishes that were being cleaned, sauces that were being divided into labeled quarts. Interns ran up from the basement with brooms and swept madly from the corners, porters tied off trash bags. The line cooks pulled down pint containers from the shelves above their stations. Inside were kits with bandanas, thermometers, pencil-thin flashlights. I'd never seen such precise chaos in my life, the fear animating everyone. Zoe talked about a 2-minute drill, but nobody had trained me on it. I assumed it was above my pay grade. Ariel pulled all the cutting boards off the table, and I grabbed her. What on earth do I do? She looked me up and down and pulled the bar mops hanging from my apron string and threw them away. She held my hands and said, "You're going to run the food, just like you were doing a minute ago. And when you get into the dining room, you smile extra hard, and when you see a man holding a flashlight and a clipboard, you make sure he sees how pretty and happy you are. Don't open the fridges. We need stable temperatures. Don't touch any food, not even a lemon or a straw at the bar. That's it."
That is Stephanie Dandler reading from her new novel, Sweet Bitter. So did you see this happen?
I've been through a dozen health inspections, and they are always organized, barely organized chaos.
Doesn't the inspector catch on to all the scurry? No?
He walks in the front door. The hostess usually stops him, and that's why we call it the two-minute drill. You have about 2 minutes until he gets into the kitchen. And it's better safe than sorry. That's why everything goes into the trash.
Stephanie Dandler's debut novel is called Sweet Bitter. After a break, she'll talk about what restaurant workers do to wind down after a shift. Ken Tucker will tell us about singer-songwriter Margaret Glasby's debut album. And John Powers reviews a new documentary about the 1964 murder of Kitty Genovese. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Alarm.com, providing smart home security using location-based automation, smart schedules, and activity alerts for home safety and efficiency. Learn more at Alarm.com/NPR. And from Rhodes Scholar, a nonprofit organization celebrating 40 years of educational travel adventures for boomers and beyond, including programs in all 50 states, at roadscholar.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. We're speaking with writer Stephanie Dandler. Her debut novel, Sweet Bitter, is about a 22-year-old woman who moves to New York and becomes immersed in the workplace culture and social life of an upscale restaurant. We've been talking about how intense, you know, life on a shift in a restaurant can be, especially a really highly professional place like this. What do you feel like when a shift ends?
Oh, utterly brain dead. I get asked a lot whether I was taking notes while I was working in the restaurant industry, and I would think to myself at the end of the night, as I'm having my shift drink, a glass of very nice Chardonnay, I would think, someone said something funny, and I can't remember it, and it will be gone forever. Then later when I was writing, I was able to access things, but you're so exhausted, but also you have all this leftover adrenaline, which is what creates this kind of nocturnal culture where everyone leaves to go to the bar at 2 a.m.
Right.
You've been working all night. There's no wind down.
Right. And the place that folks congregate in this book is called The Park Bar. Tell us why it has that name and a little bit about what happens there.
Park Bar is a real bar, and it is one street over from Union Square Cafe, where Union Square Cafe used to be. But there are a lot of restaurants in the Union Square area, and I find this is true of everywhere I've worked. There is one bar where all the servers tend to congregate at 2 a.m., kind of a stopping point between the end of the night and when they're going to go home. That also happens to be a time of night when people get into trouble. So there's lots of bad behavior at Park Bar. There's lots of hooking up. There's lots of sloppiness. And still to this day, I don't think anything good has ever happened between the hours of 2 a.m. and 4 a.m. I try to avoid them at all costs. But when you're young, it's a very exciting time to be awake when the rest of the world is asleep.
Yeah, this is not a crowd that has, you know, one glass of wine and then heads home.
No.
How much sex is there among restaurant staff?
Oh, my God. So much more than is in the book. I didn't have enough space for all the sex. Sexuality is so important to this novel, and not just because it's authentic to the culture, but because it's part of the journey that Tess is on, is understanding her sexuality and becoming a sexual creature and understanding real desire. But it also is distracting. So it can take over a narrative or a novel really quickly. And again, like with the food writing, the sex had to be essential to her development. And so there were times in which I would think, maybe she should walk into the walk-in refrigerator and see someone having sex, something I have seen before. And I thought, you know, that's just an anecdote. It's not actually adding anything to the story. The book isn't an expose of the restaurant industry. We've seen that 1,000 times. It's really focused on her journey. But there's sex all over restaurants, everywhere.
All right, well, I just have to ask, so what are some of the stranger things you have come upon in that way in restaurants?
Oh, I mean, I did walk in on a chef having sex in a walk-in refrigerator. I've also, to be, like, perfectly frank, the guests are just as bad as the servers. There are certain restaurants where two people will go into the bathroom and it's so clear and obvious, and you're thinking, really? You couldn't have waited 20 more minutes until you got home. I'm dropping the check right now.
The character here, Tess, has an infatuation with Jake, the bartender. I have a daughter who has worked in restaurants, and I'm reading this and I'm thinking, so what is appealing about Jake? Stay away from this guy. What?
It's so obvious, right?
Yeah. So tell us why she can't resist Jake.
I think that for some women, the idea of rescuing kind of a damaged, tormented, almost romantic, and I mean that like a Byron romantic hero, it's irresistible. She thinks that she will be the one to break through. She just has to work harder than the women that have come before her. And men like Jake are awful. They lie, and they're never where they're supposed to be, and they torture you mentally, and are totally unstable. But there's moments of sensitivity and lucidity and innocence. And every time she sees one of those moments with Jake, it keeps her holding on. A lot of women want to rescue men like Jake and be the one to fix them.
Were you like that?
No, I wasn't. I've always been attracted to very stable men. But I know a little bit about this.
You wrote a piece in Vogue magazine about your father. I don't know if you're comfortable talking about this, but, you know, he had suffered with addiction and was out of your life most of the time. And then you write that for a period of time when you were in high school and not getting along with your mom, you went to live with him. Do you want to share a bit about what that was like and your relationship with him?
What's interesting about the period of time you mentioned is that I hadn't no contact with him for most of my childhood, maybe once a year. And when things went badly between my mother and I went to live with him in Colorado, it would have been obvious to say he's a terrible father, but the opposite happened. I came to adore him. I loved spending time with him. I thought we had the most incredible friendship. And things with my mother were so fraught, I was so excited to have someone that I could sit with in the evenings and just chat with. I think looking back on it, I thought I was a lot more adult than I was, and I didn't need a friend. I needed a parent. And looking back on it, his irresponsibility is a little hard to stomach. But I was totally enamored. And I think that the two of us, he has three children and he's had a dozen women in his life. And I think that I'm probably the closest relationship he's ever had in his life. And it's very sad, right? This is a very sad story about loving someone very much, but not being able to have them close to you because they're toxic.
Right. And, you know, when you were talking about how this character Tess looked at Jake, I mean, in the essay, I think you talk about there's a point at which you might think that you can, and I don't know whether you're talking about your father or someone else, you know, you can.
I see.
You have more empathy. You get him. You can provide that missing ingredient, which is no one else has been able to supply all those years. And I'm wondering if...
Absolutely.
Yeah,
there's something, and that is definitely in Jake, though I did not realize it at the time, in the writing of Jake, this person that you want so desperately to change, but they're never going to change. Then the thing about Tess in the novel is she's 22 and I'm 32. And you would think that in those 10 years, I had learned something, or that we all have the ability to learn how to protect ourselves. And the point of the essay, less about my father and what kind of father he was, is that I'm still negotiating that it's an ongoing struggle to make boundaries and make good choices for yourself and protect the good things in your life.
In the book, you describe these relationships among the staff at this restaurant. I mean, they're engaged in this intense work of providing quality service and food all day, and then they're exhausted and then go to a bar at night and have all kinds of drink and drugs, and they mock each other and flirt and have all sex and all kinds of things. I'm going to quote a little piece here when you describe the relationships among the folks. You say, "We were mean, our tones short. We developed strategies against one another, plotted downfalls, worked ourselves up over small triumphs. You could have safely assumed we hated each other." It is interesting to hear that, because I think a lot of the banter among the staff here, and they're very clever, but they're also very cutting, but it doesn't seem that, it's hard for me to think of any of them who have healthy, trusting relationships with people. And it made me wonder if this pattern of intense service and kind of heavy drinking to come down is going to be appealing to people who aren't ready for intimacy, aren't ready for trusting relationships. What do you think?
Absolutely. I think that's a great observation. There is this extended adolescence quality to the world that Tess finds herself in. It's very regressive in a way, and a lot of these people are emotionally stunted and stuck. Restaurants are great places for people that are stuck because they can actually just wait there. They're waiters. I put that somewhere in the book. There's also something about New York City where you don't have to grow up immediately. You can live this lifestyle that Tess finds when she's 22, the lifestyle you just described at Park Bar. You can do that till you're 40. You can do that till you're 50, and not realize that years and decades have passed you by. And there's something really sad in that. And I've seen it happen. And I've also seen the opposite. People that are able to have really fulfilling lives from the restaurant industry, but they are often not the ones at Park Bar. There's something about that behavior and that not taking care. There's no self-care yet. That feels very adolescent to me.
There's been a lot of buzz in the literary world about this book. There's a story that you were waiting in a restaurant and handed a manuscript to an editor at a big publishing house. This is exaggerated, right? But is there something to it?
There is something to it, but it's a fairy tale version of what happened. I had an agent, Mel Flashman at Trident Media, who I adore, and we were about to send the book out. And when you're sending a book out, you make a list of editors at different publishing houses, and we had crafted that list together. You know, you spend like a month doing that. And 2 days before the list was going out, I was waiting on one of my regulars at a restaurant in the West Village called Bouvette. And I'd been waiting on him for like a year and a half. And for some reason, that day, the conversation turned and he said, "I heard you're a writer." And I said, "Oh, yeah, aren't you an editor?" It was like very slow. Because when I was in my server mode, I wasn't thinking about writing. I was fully present, just trying to keep up with my tables. And he was gracious enough to say that he would read it. And he sent me a text a few days later, and he said that nothing bad would happen, that the book was fantastic, and he hoped that he could get a meeting with me. And then I was in his offices at Knopf, and that is history.
Well, Stephanie Dandler, congratulations on the book. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Stephanie Dandler's debut novel is Sweet Bitter. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews singer-songwriter Margaret Glasby's first album. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from AT&T, with a network and solutions for helping companies sense and adapt to meet the demands of business. Discover the power of and with AT&T. And from Lumosity, brain training with games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. From scientists and game designers exploring new ways to research human cognition. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
This is Fresh Air. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Margaret Glasby's debut album, Emotions and Math. Glasby, who's 27, produced the album herself. She plays a variety of instruments, including the fiddle, but on the album she concentrates on the guitar. Here's Ken.
Looks like a new forgot. To be who you'd want. Yes, I've been sitting silent because I thought you'd like to be quiet. But I don't want to watch my mouth. No, I don't want to act like I can't figure it out. I don't want to hold you till I'm good and ready to.
I don't want to be on pins and needles, Margaret Glasby sings on that song, which has a lyric about not wanting to alter her behavior to try and please someone she cares for. It's a song about how we sometimes, often without being conscious of it, readjust our essential nature to simply move a relationship along, to keep things going. It's a nicely complex idea to stuff into a catchy song with a strong guitar line. Turns out, this is what Margaret Glasby specializes in. Complexity that unfurls with deceptive directness.
What with all the beautiful fish in the sea, you keep on coming back to me, and I'm waiting on the day you wake up and say you don't want me.
I do.
You don't need me.
You on my mind every night of the week. Stop being so nice.
Every woman in there.
That's You Don't Want Me, in which Glaspie's forceful guitar strumming contradicts the neediness of the lyric. But that's only how it seems initially. As the song progresses, you realize Glaspie has thought through what it means to be desired and knows that it works both ways. A number of songs on emotions and math operate in this manner, including the title song.
When you're gone, I start to snooze the alarm, 'cause I stay up until 4 in the morning, counting all the days till you're back, shivering in an ice cold bath of emotions and math. Oh, it's a shame and I'm to blame, 'cause we're all until you go and I start losing control without a warning.
One recurring strategy Glaspie employs is to launch a song as confessional singer-songwriter material before revealing it as tough-minded rock music. In a tune called Situation, Glaspie sings about someone who's been condescending and controlling, or rather, attempting to do some controlling, and she's having none of that. There's an angry bite to the way she delivers the lyric that is echoed by the song's barbed guitar hook.
Take your hands off of me. There's nothing wrong with me. I don't like sympathy. Don't you dare pity me, 'cause you don't know my situation. We've had at most one conversation. Don't come out of the blue and tell me what to do.
As a guitarist, Glaspie favors echo and distortion while keeping the melody ringingly clear. This frees her vocals to explore a wide range of tones: guttural threats and irritation, higher pitched yearning, chatty forthrightness, sarcastic disbelief at the idiocy or obtuseness of the person in front of her. Listening to one song after another, it starts to occur to you, this is someone I'd really like to have a conversation with, or maybe avoid one. She's both impressive and intimidating.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed Margaret Glaspie's debut album, Emotions and Math. Coming up, John Powers reviews a new documentary about the 1964 murder of Kitty Genovese. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. The new documentary, The Witness, tells the story of one of the most talked-about crimes in modern American history, the 1964 murder of Kitty Genovese. Director James Solomon traces the attempts of the victim's younger brother, Bill, to make sense of what happened to his sister. Our critic at large, John Power, says it gets you thinking about what happens when a news story becomes a legend.
Every culture has an unofficial mythology, a collection of emblematic stories that nearly everyone knows and believes, even if they're not altogether true. One of this country's darker myths centers on the murder of Kitty Genovese, a 28-year-old New Yorker stabbed to death near her apartment in Queens on March 13, 1964. It wasn't the victim or killer who entered pop mythology. It was their audience. A few days after the crime, the New York Times ran an article reporting that while Genovese shrieked for help during three separate knife attacks, 38 neighbors watched for half an hour and did nothing. Almost overnight, and for nearly half a century thereafter, her murder prompted breastbeating about urban heartlessness and American apathy. All those selfish bystanders who didn't want to get involved. Like many of you, I was raised on this ghastly story, which has been rehearsed over and over in everything from Perry Mason to Lena Dunham's show Girls. That's one reason I was so engrossed by The Witness, a new documentary that shows us the case in entirely new ways. Filmmaker James Solomon follows Kitty's younger brother, Bill Genovese, who decades after the crime is still as obsessed with what happened as his siblings are eager to put it behind them. Tooling around in a wheelchair, Bill tracks down everyone from Kitty's then neighbors to reporters who covered the case. Turns out things weren't nearly so simple as they once seemed. It isn't merely that the Times' story was filled with errors. There were two attacks, not three. Most of the witnesses heard only random screams, and a couple of them did call the police. We discover that Kitty's death was not so lonely as we've always believed. Bill also interviews journalists to learn how this particular version of the story became the one we all know. Here, CBS newsman Mike Wallace teases a radio broadcast on the murder, then answers Bill's questions about how the story became so big.
This is Mike Wallace. Why did 38 people fail to act? The answer to that question concerns every one of us who fears, perhaps, that apathy has become part of our way of life.
The question becomes, was it worth all the attention it got, or was it a media creation?
Oh, I think to a certain degree it was a media creation. No one investigated the 38, no one followed up on it or anything of that nature.
Do you have any feel for why that would have been with this case versus any other case?
Because it was taken seriously by the New York Times.
Of course, even the New York Times was never powerful enough to make the Genovese murder a touchstone for 50 years. So how did it happen? For starters, the mythic version has a thrillingly awful clarity. A girl gets killed as her neighbors callously watch, and that enters your head and sticks. I heard it as a kid and never forgot it. Then, too, it fits perfectly into a modern ecosystem of ideas and feelings about urban isolation and the collapse of community. It clearly confirmed the worldview of the Times' editor on the piece, Abe Rosenthal, who highlighted the bleakness to create a splashy story. For Bill Genovese, this official narrative wasn't enough. Kitty's murder changed his life irrevocably, even leading him to serve in Vietnam, because he wasn't going to be apathetic. But his investigations keep leading him to a truth of life deeper than journalism, its gnawing ambiguity. He discovers unfillable holes in the story, loose ends that can never be tied up. The killer, a sociopath named Winston Mosley, won't talk to him. And Bill never learns why, if folks called the cops that night, no cops came to help her. Bill's research also gives us and him something important. It starts to restore the individuality his sister lost when her murder became a legend. We see footage of her as a lovely young woman dancing. We hear friends say she was a brilliant mimic. Bill talks to old guys from the bar she managed, and they obviously adored her. She was one of the boys, they say. Her death devastated Marianne Zulanko, who was Kitty's roommate and romantic partner, a fact that didn't come out back then. The Witness also serves as a useful moral corrective. The mythic version of Kitty's story feeds our most cynical paranoia by suggesting we're all alone in a cruel, indifferent world. It saps our spirit by making the world appear even worse than it actually is. In this week, when one hate-filled man murdered 49 innocent souls at a nightclub, it's worth remembering that the citizens of Orlando, far from refusing to get involved, lined up block after block to donate blood.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. He co-wrote with filmmaker Wong Kar-wai a new book called WKW, The Cinema of Wong Kar-wai. If you'd like to hear Fresh Air interviews you missed, check out our podcast. You can hear our interview about the new documentary series O.J. Made in America about O.J. Simpson, or the interview with Claire Hoffman about growing up in a community devoted to transcendental meditation, or our interview about the 2010 election and Republican congressional redistricting, and many others. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Challoner. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Staples, with packing, shipping, and moving supplies for both business and personal needs 7 days a week. Learn more at staples.com. Staples, make more happen. And from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, where treatment options include targeted therapies guided by genomic testing and immunotherapies that use the body's immune system to help fight the cancer. More at cancercenter.com.